Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome. This is Walter Davis, and welcome to the Community Coalition Internet Radio Show. My name is Walter Davis, and I'm here this evening with one of my good friends, Mr. Jim Bell. How are you doing, Jim?
Doing great. Glad to be here.
Well, great. I have a lot of respect for you and your work with energy sustainability and solar power, so I consider you to be an expert in this area, and you know, someone that I really want to help promote your message.
Well, I really appreciate that, and I'll do my best.
Perfect, perfect. Okay, well, Jim, go ahead and why don't you tell the audience something about yourself? Introduce yourself.
Okay, I was pretty much a regular person. I went to high school, and the only thing I really did very well and went in was sports, but I wasn't any champion by any means. And then I finally got through high school, and I went to junior college, and mainly there I just escaping from home and being a party animal and playing on the basketball team, and that was kind of my life. And I school was just some place to go, and you kept your grades good enough so that you could stay eligible, and that was about it. Then I got married and moved up to Long Beach, and of course I had to go to work and all that kind of stuff, but I still wanted to go to school. So I ended up going to Long Beach State and started having some trouble also with my marriage at the time, and of course that throws you into a totally tailspin. And I was just, kind of there feeling really naked and raw and just going, what's this about? What's life all about? What is the meaning of all this? And why do I feel this way? And, went through that for quite a while. And I'm in a way, I'm thankful for it because it, like, woke me up and it got me, going to, where I'm going now. And in the process of trying to find myself after that, I ended up doing volunteer work for the Farm Workers Union for about 5 months, and ended up on the national headquarters as doing construction work because they found that I was a carpenter. Great experience, but I was looking for something bigger. It's like farm workers, certainly are good people to help because they're getting the short end of the stick, like a lot of people. But it wasn't big enough for me. It just seemed like the problems were more immense than all of that, and I didn't know anything about ecology or I had a high school biology class, and it was about my experience with that. But I was definitely searching, and the Farm Workers was the first place I went. Then I came back down here, and I got involved with some groups at UCSD who were trying to educate students about what the education was really about versus what they were, the bill of goods they were sold. We actually wrote this thing called a disorientation manual. So that was one of the things that we did. But I still, even after that, I felt it was still too small, like what we were doing. We're all just complaining about stuff. And I started having this idea of some kind of a farm where people could go and make a living and all that. It was very, very vague at the time. And nobody else seemed to be very much interested in it. Finally, I read this book by Barry Commoner, who I believe is still alive. He's a biologist, and he's written a lot of books. And I don't even remember the whole title. Oh, actually, I finally found that I wrote it down. It was called The Poverty of Power, Energy and the Economic Crisis. I mean, it sounds like it could have been written today, right? And that book basically laid it out, and just, you know, as I got to the end of it, I realized, hey, the human family is destroying its own life support system. And that's, you know, that is really going to work out. I mean, makes everything else an illusion if we lose that. And that was back in 1973, and ever since then I've kind of dedicated my life to figuring out, well, if we're doing things badly that hurt the planet, how can we do them in a better way that fits how our planet works and is more peaceful amongst each other in terms of, you know, peace among people and also world peace. So that's where it kind of brings us up to date. And since 1973, I've written a couple books. That was what I thought was going to be the hard part, because writing doesn't come naturally to me. But when you have passion, you eventually get things done. And I had a lot of help from, you know, people to help me. But the idea of the book was to show that, well, here's how we can do all these things. Oh, you want energy? Well, we get energy this way now, and it causes all these ecological and life support system problems and people problems. How do we get our energy in a different way so we don't cause those problems? I mean, you know, pretty common sense thing. And I did the same thing with water, and I did the same thing with food. And of course, all of this was a learning curve for me in the process. To realize, well, you know, if you're going to live anywhere on a finite planet, you have to figure out a way to get the things you need and want that don't hurt the productive potential of your part of the planet's life support system. Like if you grow food, let's grow it so that it doesn't deplete the soil. Let's even plan it so that when we ship food to urban areas, when people eat the food and go to the bathroom, they don't put a bunch of poisons in there along with the human waste, and not being poisoned, you can compost that materials and take it back to the farmland. That's like what I call a circular nutrient flow. If we want to have sustainable agriculture, that's what we're going to have to do. And up to this point, we've masked it with using massive quantities of fossil fuels to, you know, sort of be able to mine nutrients that we're shipping to urban areas and flushing down the toilet into the ocean, that we can keep those nutrients, get those nutrients back to the farmland again. I kind of realized this when, you know, I started hearing these, it was early on in my discoveries here, but we were shipping all this grain to Russia, and I just kind of realized that, well, we're also shipping our soil micronutrients to Russia. And if that's going to be something that we want to do, we should be collecting Russian sewage and composting and bringing it back here to put on the farmland. I mean, once again, circular nutrient flows. And the beginning, what I finally came to was that figuring out how to do these things, you know, like understanding how your planet works and then working out ways to, you know, to do the things you want to do so that they're in harmony with that, was relatively easy. The hard part is to get permission to do it. You know, I've run for mayor a couple times, and hoping that people would see the light and I would get elected and I'd be able to put these things in motion on that level, but it hasn't happened.
So for our international audience, you ran for mayor for the city of San Diego. We are broadcasting from San Diego County right now.
Yeah, and when we spoke earlier, we were talking about energy. You want to go on to that?
Sure.
Because it's an important, it's a very important part, because if you don't control your energy, you know, security, supply, and price, you can be knocked flat on your, you know, on your back, figuratively, by an energy shutoff or a severe restriction. I mean, we see this all over the world. So if you can become renewable energy self-sufficient, then it's emanating from your own county or city, the whole world can go pretty crazy, and you're going to be pretty untouched, except things like this radioactive fallout from Japan that's still occurring.
Before we get into that, can you give me the definition of that? What is sustainability to you? And a short answer.
Yeah, sustainability is basically, you know, being able to do things in ways that work with others and work with your planet's life support system. You know, like that example I gave with the growing the food, like an unsustainable way to grow food would be to use up your soil resources, you know, through either bad, you know, selling things to different places, you know, not getting the nutrients back in the ground. Eventually, that's going to fail. And so you have to figure out, well, how can we grow food in ways that don't poison the soil, that don't poison the groundwater, that don't extract groundwater faster than the natural recharge rate. If we do all those things, we have a very good shot at having a life support sustaining agriculture. Does that answer your question?
Sure. And
you do that for everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're always looking at the cradle-to-cradle cost, what I call true cost, or you can call them cradle-to-cradle cost, of everything humans do. I mean, we're the only creature that's out of sync. I mean, just naturally, every other creature on this planet, plant or animal, all live in harmony with the planet's life support system. Yeah, lions attack, gazelles, and they eat them and all that. But they don't ever do anything that's going to damage future generations, because they put pollution someplace or we'll just hide this away for the time being and we'll be gone before it shows up again and nobody can blame us. You know, it's kind of like that attitude if anybody even gets to the place where they think about that.
Now, we've already seen an example of that with the Dust Bowl.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Dust Bowl was several years ago, and this, puts even more importance to the, thing that happened in Japan. We were getting these huge dust clouds, which was changing our sunsets and amount of sunlight that hits the ground. They were blowing from China. They were being picked up by the winds and blown all the way across the ocean, and we were getting it, and Canada was getting it. Fortunately that wasn't radioactive, but it's still not good for China's, future sustainable growing of food. And we experienced that in the Dust Bowl.
Now, you have some very different views on things like electric cars and other things. Can you talk about that? Can you talk about your vision of electric cars?
Yeah, well, maybe we'll back up a little bit and just say, well, okay, what's the goal? It's like, well, I'm here and I want to get over there. And then there's like, well, why do you want to get over there? Well, maybe because over there is more exciting or it's prettier or it's a unique experience or something like that. But the first step in terms of, reducing transportation is to redesign communities so that you have pretty much everything you need in your local community. Like I live in Ocean Beach, which is it's sort of a suburb of the city of San Diego. And it's a community somewhat like that. I mean, we have roads and everything, but since I've moved here, I went from driving maybe 12,000 miles a year, which isn't a lot, to driving just over 3,000 miles a year, because I can walk to most of the places I want to go, like to do grocery shopping or to go to the hardware store or just to go downtown and see what's going on, downtown Ocean Beach. Whereas most people, they live like in a suburb somewhere where maybe they have a shopping mall somewhere down the road, at all. But they don't really have the variety you can have in an urban area. So, like, I'm not against urban areas. Matter of fact, I think they offer, great possibilities. You can afford to have a more complex sewage system if it's serving a lot of people, and you can have professional technicians and all that kind of stuff, which is kind of hard if you're out, in the suburb on a half acre of lot and you're on a leach field. So,
you support, electric cars. What's your position on electric cars?
Well, first thing was, the balanced community design. The next thing is look at, well, how do you maybe you have to carry something, back from the store or whatever. Well, why don't you have a little internal solar solar electric-powered tram system so that older people or people who have to haul something can, you know, get it around the community. And then each tram system is hooked to a local hub, which would be a place where you would have your buses, or if it's big enough, maybe you have a trolley station there. So people would, you know, get to the hub through their local transportation, and then from the hub, they're off to another place, which in effect, every hub becomes an express route to that new hub. And then from that hub, you would internally transport yourself in that community that you're now in, where if it's 100 miles away, or even if it's, you know, if it's 5 miles away. And then you start looking at, okay, what kind of, you know, for the transportation that we want to do that's beyond all the systems that I talked about, and you say, well, let's have an electric car. Well, if that electric car is built cradle-to-cradle life support sustainability, and I know I'm introducing a new kind of a new concept, it's just because a car is electric doesn't mean it's not, when you look at every cost associated with it, that it's better than, say, a real efficient gasoline-powered car or diesel-powered car. So we haven't actually made those comparisons yet, but in general, if an electric car is manufactured, you know, with that intent to do the best you can to not, you know, create more toxins to go into the world or whatever. Even the solar panels. Solar panels aren't perfect yet, but they're far better than burning fossil fuels to get the same result as far as electricity. They do have some, you know, some pollution associated with their manufacture, but I've been, you know, sort of keeping in tune with that, and I believe eventually they're going to be grown. They will actually be able to grow solar panels, and they're already beginning to do that, you know, on the experimental level. So that means that it's potential to make solar panels so that you could, you know, once they wore out, you could recycle them completely back into new solar panels, so they would never degrade in terms of the use you could put them to when you went ahead. Just like a piece of copper, you're using it as a pipe. The pipe gets smashed or something. You melt it. And then you can make a new pipe out of it. And it never really degrades. And in fact, it takes a lot less energy to make a new pipe out of recycled copper than it does to make it out of ore. So you gain both, you know, both places. And that's the same way I want to look at electric cars. Well, we got the batteries, we got all these different things. Well, what are we creating that's going to be haunting our youth and future generations? So sometimes I don't have the exact answer at this point because we haven't really done the research. Everything is more or less as things are being done in the green world today. It's pretty much shooting from the hip without very much knowledge to back it up. I mean, I'm happy it's happening, but I'm frightened by how it's happening.
So what I'm hearing you say is that essentially, the carbon footprint involved in manufacturing a electric car could be more detrimental to the environment than just a fossil fuel burning vehicle. Is that pretty much on track?
That would be a potentially one outlook. It could be that. It could be that the body parts are made out of a plastic that's going to eventually end up in the swirling around the ocean like all the other plastic is, because it isn't designed to be completely recyclable into a new car body or whatever. And you kind of have to look, you know, even like you say, well, okay, now we've eliminated the motor. We have an electric motor, but that's got a lot of copper in it. And where did that copper come from? And what, you know, what kind of impacts happened to the people where they got the copper from and the animals and everything else? And you realize, well, gee, there's almost no, you know, we talk about solid waste and all that kind of stuff, but mining is exempt. That's why we have these big things where they put all these coal waste from coal mines in a big lagoon, and they're there for years, and pretty soon the thing breaks and it pollutes everything downstream all the way to the ocean and ultimately the ocean too. Because the true cost of doing what they were doing, it doesn't really appear. I mean, there's maybe we should talk a little bit more about the true cost idea. What do you think?
Okay, go ahead.
Well, this kind of when I was writing my first book, which is free on my website, which I understand people can get off your website, all they really have to do is just type in Jim Bell into their search engine, and I'll come up on that first page. Usually, one of the top names of all the Jim Bells around. And it's a pretty simple website, and you can just go there and find everything that I've done there, videos and all that kind of stuff.
Let me interrupt you also, just 1 second.
Sure.
I did put a link to Jim Bell's website on this radio broadcast. It is jimbell.com. And some of the material that you have on there in synopsis is energy production and procurement options. There's a section about analysis, which has information on return on investment.
Right.
Energy and economic security, economic opportunity, employment opportunity, social and environmental good, proof of concept, and then there's several very helpful charts. One dealing with electricity, self-sufficiency in San Diego County, economic benefits of electricity, energy, and direct and indirect job year totals, job creation comparison, 2010 to 2050, electricity procurement cash flow comparison, electricity procurement cash flow illustration, and San Diego County electricity use profile. So there's quite a bit of very good information. I also see that you have calculations for direct job years with PowerLink, calculations for indirect job years implementing.
Yeah, like those. That's a very good thing to talk about too. Is like the difference between direct job years would be the jobs that were, building the power line out to the, out through the Mojave Desert and eventually to Calexico, the direct jobs on the other side for becoming renewable electricity self-sufficient would be, actually installing solar panels on rooftops and over parking lots and making buildings and homes more efficient so that they use less electricity. And what we figured out was we said, well, how many, we searched the literature and said, well, how many jobs would be produced, say, putting in insulation and double glazed windows and all those kinds of thing per $100,000 spent or per $1 million spent. And I did the same thing with the PowerLink. And actually, I got the numbers from the PowerLink from SDG&E through one of their spokespeople that basically said, of course, the prices jumped all around when we wrote the paper, and it was co-authored by Dr. Heather Honay, who's faculty in the College of Business at San Diego State University. They were quoting $1.3 billion to put that PowerLink in, and the spokesman from SDG&E said, asked him, well, how much of that will be labor? The actual people who do the work, and he said in general, general rule of thumb is 40% would pay for labor, so that gave us a number to start with to look at the opposite, like becoming renewable electricity self-sufficient locally and realizing that efficiency is more cost-effective than building any kind of capacity, but you need capacity because you can't save everything unless you want to, live like we did a long time ago when we didn't have any electricity, lights, or even fire. That paper is available on my page. If you click on the buttons on the left-hand side, and it's the second button, second or third button down. It's it was called Green Papers. Green Papers, and that's the first thing that comes up. And that's a pretty good paper because it goes on the assumption that electricity is only 10 cents a kilowatt hour, which is cheaper than it is now. But we try to look at the true cost pricing even in that article and in my own work to, try to, say, well, we have there's two kinds of costs that you have. Like there's some direct costs that everybody can see, and then there's indirect costs that are not so obvious. And so you have to look at all those costs and you know add them up to come you know to come some to some conclusion. Does it make sense? Like for example, when I wrote that first book, I was pretty enamored with concentrating solar collectors and you know had done research on you know how big of a system would you have to have, and I think it came out to be about you know half of New Mexico to would produce enough electricity for the United States. I you know don't quote me on that, but it was sort of in that range, and I even figured out they had to be spaced because when they track, you know, like if they're all pointed toward the sun in the morning and the sun is low in the sky, the front ones are shading all the back ones, so you don't get to hit them all until the sun is high enough to so that it's past the shading of any of them, and the further apart they are, the sooner that happens. So it's a balance between how close should they be to maximize the labor and resources and all that, you know, to get as much electricity as possible. And when you get them so close, how much, you know, when do you start, you know, losing on the production, even though you may have more systems, you know, in the same space. But then it's like, well, can, you know, when those things wear out, can they be recycled? You basically look at all that, and that's what true cost pricing is about. And what I suggested in the book was that, well, why don't we hire, you know, somebody like the President of the United States could do it, you know, set up a commission of people who don't represent the industry, who don't represent anybody who would have a vested interest one way or the other. And I didn't think I said this in the first book, but I was thinking about it recently and thinking, well, maybe Consumer Reports magazine would be a good company to hire to do that, to answer questions like, well, gee, I can go to the store and buy these styrofoam cups, but what do they ultimately cost me when we trace all the costs associated with it, you know, cradle to cradle? And if we determine that cost and we added it to the retail price of those cups when people went to the store to buy it, very few people would buy them. And the even better than that is that it would incentivize all the companies who have, say, a new kind of material that they could use that would have the same results as styrofoam, but the product was completely biodegradable at the end of its life. Whereas now, because when companies become successful in our political system, they can get money to politicians who are on their side, so to speak, to elect people. I mean, some people, I mean, Will Rogers said this way back when, that we have the best government money can buy. And I think that's even more true today than it was back then, just because of this. And then with the Supreme Court decision allowing corporations to dump all the money they want, they only have to keep track of it into the political system, we have even more of the best candidates money can buy. And
we just did a story on that on my television show, Progress in San Diego, with Common Cause, discussing the ruling from the Supreme Court that allows corporations to give unlimited contributions to political candidates.
And causes or whatever, anything they want.
And that video is up on YouTube right now. And the other thing that we want to point out is that these research papers you have, the green papers on your website, are free of charge.
They are, and even my books. And people can actually print them out off the web. I think you can even print parts of them. I'm not sure the videos are available, but that's because we haven't figured out how to make them so you could just bring them to yourself. But I guess you don't really need to, since you can just go to my website and see them anytime.
Well, I have ways of doing that, so we'll talk about that on another conversation.
But you see the whole idea of true cost pricing is like we don't even have to get every exact cost. You know, we wait until we have every cost before we add it to the price. We just have to get the gross costs, because those gross costs are enough to sway the marketplace to bring new players into the game who have better products. And like Dell Computer is a good example. They actually take their computers back as part of, you know, we buy a computer, we'll take it back when you get a new one or want a new one. Right now, that costs them extra money. I mean, they're doing it because they see it as a, you know, PR. We can be greener. We can bring that out, and maybe people will buy us more of us for that reason. If you had true cost pricing, they would be probably the cheapest computer around, even though they could be the best computer. But in terms of the total cost or cradle to cradle cost, they would be the cheapest. And what you would, in one fell swoop, you would be incentivizing all computer manufacturers to redesign their materials so that they can go right back into industry again once their useful life is over. And that has all kinds of other advantages, and this comes into the true cost again, because now you're recycling everything. Nothing is going to the landfill. Well, you don't have to go out into the world and harvest more virgin materials, because you just need, you know, you're losing so little that you just need to maybe make up a little bit once in a while. So that takes all the pressure off nature of us going out there and digging in the ground or cutting down the plants and things like that to get the new resource, which the way it is now generally ends up in the landfill.
So you had a very interesting concept that we talked about earlier, and that was basically how solar panels could essentially pay for themselves in terms of being installed if people didn't have to put any money down out of their pockets to get them installed. Could you talk about that some?
Sure. This kind of comes under the heading of what's called community choice aggregate municipalities. And there is a state law, it was signed by Governor Schwarzenegger, that allows communities, like a city council, can declare themselves a community choice aggregate municipality. And the reason they would want to do that is because it basically breaks the monopoly that their local utility has over them. And it's the key to the name is choice, because you don't have to dump your existing utility company, but you completely change the relationship to them, because now they have to be as much beholden to you as they are to their shareholders. Whereas now, if the shareholders are happy, they got their jobs. You know, the management keeps their jobs, whether you're unhappy or not. And it's very hard to, you know, get rid of them. But this law, I know the guy who got this passed, and I told him he was a genius to catch the utility company so asleep. I mean, that's what the whole, you know, the election when PG&E was trying to kill that power was Prop 16, by making it that if a community wanted to do that, they'd have to get a 2/3 vote from their citizens to make it possible for them to become a CCA. You know, in a way saying it'd be very hard to get two-thirds vote on anything, as we've seen with our government and bed budgets and things like that. But thankfully that was defeated, and city councils and mayors, board supervisor members, and even water boards and things like that can actually evoke this rule, and then they can go out to bid. And so the way it would work, say the county of San Diego decided to do this, and all the cities were in it with them, the first thing they would do is put together a request for proposals. Now, this is something that cities are pretty, you know, knowledgeable about how to do. And that request for proposals would basically say, hey, look, looking at the energy situation in the world and looking at all the pollution that the way we get energy now causes and all that, we decided that we want to become renewable energy self-sufficient, or in the case of the paper that's on the website, we want to become renewable electricity self-sufficient by installing solar panels on rooftops and over parking lots. And we think there's enough room to do that. And actually, you know, when I was doing the first calculations, we were assuming only 10% efficient PV panels. And even at that level of inefficiency, 21% coverage of our roofs and parking lots, assuming 1,000 square feet of roof and parking lot per capita, would produce all the electricity we need, and it would produce enough so that we would put enough extra in the daytime when the sun was shining into the grid that when we bought back at nighttime, we'd just, in effect, be trading electricity kilowatt hour for kilowatt hour. So here you are. Your city decides to do this. You go, okay, what does this mean? Well, pretty soon, somebody from the city or an architect or somebody like that would say, well, we would like to evaluate your home and property, business, whatever it is, to see what we could do to save energy, to make your house more energy efficient. And we're going to do this for no out-of-pocket cost. There's no out-of-pocket cost for doing this for you. Okay, now say you used $10 or $100 worth of electricity each month. Okay, first of all, the agreement with the architect or whoever it was, expert doing it, to say, well, we're going to put a couple skylights there because then a lot of the light you want to use in the daytime could be done with daylighting. So you don't really need to use electric lights very much. You know, if you do, you've got spotlights for certain tasks and things like that, that's fine. We'll put the most efficient light in there too, and you have single glazed windows. So let's change out all your windows, and let's put put more insulation in your walls, and put more insulation up in your attic, and you know, try to do everything to make your house, apartment, business, more efficient, including for a house, replacing the refrigerator with one that's twice as efficient. Once again, at no out of pocket cost to you. Even a washing machine, and then after that is all completed, your bill goes down to $90 a month. It was $100 a month now, but now you're getting the same energy service that you were getting before, but you're only paying $90 a month. But the way it works is that by creating that kind of efficiency, you're actually going to be only using $50 as much electricity as you were using before to get the same energy service, the same amount of lighting, the same amount of refrigeration, the same amount of whatever. So when you go to pay your bill, you're paying $90 when if you had financed the whole thing yourself, you'd only be paying $40, to make the payments on it. I mean, you'd only be paying $50 to make the payments on it. But since you signed on to this other deal, or you were signed on as soon as your sister city became a CCA, then you will always enjoy that 10% positive cash flow as long as your energy services are remain the same. And you would actually reduce it if they got lower. And eventually that extra $40 you're paying every month that still gives you that 10% positive cash flow goes to pay off your system, and you continue doing that until all the houses and buildings in San Diego County have solar, if it makes sense, and have efficiency improvements, and that makes sense for all every building. So you have no upfront money, just you're signed up to the program just when your city does it. You can opt out if you say no, I'm just stubborn, I want to stay with SDG&E. You can, or even any other arrangement you might want to make. But all of this, would be done. We'd have pretty much full employment for, about 40 years to take to get all this done. And we were completely reversing our cash flow. Like now, when you think about, okay, electricity, but if you think about gasoline or natural gas, none of that comes from our local situation. So whenever we pay money for energy of any kind and much less electricity, that money leaves our economy. But then somebody says, well, wait a minute, we have electric plants here. There's a plant in Escondido. There's the San Onofre plant. There's one in Chula Vista, though I hear they're going to tear that down, which is true. We produce electricity locally. Yeah, but that electricity wouldn't get produced if we didn't import the natural gas or the nuclear fuel to run in the plant. So that's important. And it turns out that, I did the calculations on natural gas, that, say electricity is 10 cents a kilowatt hour. I don't remember the exact number, but it's like about 78% of that cost, that 10%, 10 cents, is the cost of the natural gas. And if the price of electricity goes higher, the cost of producing it is what's called a fixed cost. That stays the same because we've been doing it for years and we know how to build these plants and we know how to run them and things like that. But the fuel isn't fixed. I mean, it happens to be whatever the market is, you know, going to bear. And now natural gas is, sort of on the low side from what it was going for a while. But it is ultimately finite, or, you know, some people believe that oil is being produced in the Earth's crust and things like that. And, you know, who knows, maybe it is. But one thing for sure is we're certainly using it up faster than it's being produced, because otherwise why do we have to keep going deeper and deeper into the ocean and deeper and deeper on land to try to get a hold of it? So these things are not sure and they're not steady and they cause all kinds of problems. Whereas you have, say, solar efficiency, you can do efficiency pretty much without any, you know, any negative ecological consequence. There are methods to do it. I don't know if I mentioned this. You know, I talked about the styrofoam. There's a company back east that's now making a styrofoam type of material as a fungus, like mushrooms, and they grow it on old walnut shells or pecan shells. You know, basically waste materials from the food industry, and they grow it and they make basically insulation. And it works just like styrofoam, but ultimately if it's put in a compost pile, it'll break down and the animals will eat it and be happy. So we, you know, even without true cost pricing, we have different green things coming into the forefront that have found themselves to be competitive, even though the market is tilted against their activity because of subsidies that go for the thing that hurts us. I'm pretty much against subsidies across the board, because even when they're well-intended, they generally create, you know, like knee-jerk situations that cause us to do something that we otherwise wouldn't do if the real costs were on the table. Are you still there? Hello? I don't know if I'm on the air or what. What's happening? Well, I'm going to hang up and call back.